Good morning. I'm Christopher Renner, and the convener today. Our welcoming words are from Martha Kirby. We who are assembled have made a conscious choice. We live intentionally. May we keenly attend to the silent, pulsing needs here present at this altar, made sacred by the power of our communion. The Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan is a welcoming congregation, meaning regardless of your age, gender, sexual orientation, race, ethnicity, economic status, or political orientation, you are welcomed here. We especially extend a warm welcome to our many visitors who are here with us today and invite them to sign up for our mailing list. We are always liking to add people to our mailing list. And to join us for coffee and conversation in the Alsop room following this morning's service. Our service today is the first in our month-long reflection on what does it mean to be a people of intention. We will explore how do we intentionally live our identities as Unitarian Universalists, and what difference does being a Unitarian Universalist make in our lives? We will hear from three of our own congressional members today, Sandy Nelson, J.C. Hamm, and myself, as to why we are UUs before Reverend Johnston's thoughts on the topic. In addition, we will also have with us today, as you can see, the traveling UU chalice that is connecting us to the larger UU community and to remind us that this summer the Unitarian Universalist Association General Assembly will be held in Kansas City. As for announcements, I would like to draw your attention to the announcements in the order of service. In particular, there are a couple of things. First is the Kansas People's Agenda Rally on Wednesday. You'll find a nice announcement about that. UUs from across the state have played an important role in planning this event, and we hope to have a strong showing from our congregation. Also, immediately following the service today, we will have a congressional meeting at 12:15. Congregational. What did I say? Congressional. Yeah, all right. See where my mind's at this morning. To vote on the continuation of our developmental ministry contract with Reverend Johnston. There are also a couple other things. The guests at your table containers are due back today, and you can deliver them to the Juniper Room, Jupiter Room, which is down at the end of the hallway. And there are a few items left from the Christmas sale, and so this is sort of your last chance to make those post-Christmas purchases. What's left, if you were one of the artists that created something, you can take it with you, and if it's been left, then it might go to the fit closet or something like that. But we need to get the table cleared off today, all right? All right, lighting the chalice. We will have members of the board, Chris and Eli, will be our lighters today. But before we get into that, I would like to do a little history about the history of our chalice. We have the traveling chalice reminding us that our General Assembly will be held in Kansas City in June. The flaming chalice has become a well-known symbol of Unitarian Universalism. It unites our members in worship and symbolizes the spirit of our work. The flaming chalice combines two archetypes, a drinking vessel and a flame. And as a religious symbol, has different meanings to different beholders. The chalice and flame were brought together as a Unitarian symbol by the Austrian artist Hans Deutsch in 1941. When he lived in Paris during the 1930s, Deutsch drew critical cartoons of Adolf Hitler. When the Nazis invaded Paris in 1940, he had to abandon all he had and fled as a refugee, first to the south of France, then into Spain, and finally with an altered passport to Portugal, one of the few neutral countries during that Second World War. In Portugal, he met Reverend Charles Joy, the executive director of the Unitarian Universalist Committee. The USC was new, It was founded in Boston to assist Eastern Europeans, among them Unitarians, as well as Jews, who needed to escape Nazi persecution. Reverend Joy oversaw a secret network of couriers and agents, and Hans Deutsch made his lasting contribution to the USC and, as it turned out, to Unitarian Universalism. With a pencil and ink, he drew a chalice with a flame. It was, Joy wrote it to his board in Boston the following: "A chalice with a flame, a kind of chalice which the Greeks and Romans put on their altars. The holy oil burning in it is a symbol of helpfulness and sacrifice." This was in the mind of the artist. In fact, however, that it remotely suggests a cross was not in his mind, but to me, this also has its merits. We do not limit our work to Christians. Indeed, at present moment, our work is 9/10 for the Jews. Yet we do stem from the Christian tradition, and a cross does symbolize Christianity as its central theme of sacrificial love. The story of Hans Deutsch reminds us that the symbol of the flaming chalice stood in the beginning for a life of service. When Deutsch designed the flaming chalice, he had never seen a Unitarian or a Universalist church or heard a sermon by a Unitarian Universalist preacher. What he had seen was faith in action, people who were willing to risk all for others in a time of urgent need. And as the war wore on, this new symbol became a marker for Jews trying to escape the Nazi Holocaust. People would put it on their houses, and people knew that was a safe house. So, as our chalice is lit today, I ask you to join in reading in unison a passage by Kenneth Patton, which is in the center pages of your order of service. "We arrive out of many singular rooms, walking over branching streets. We come to be assured that brothers and sisters surround us to restore their images in our eyes. We enlarge our visions, common speaking and singing. We try again that solitude found in the midst of those who seek their hidden reckonings. Our eyes reclaim the remembrant faces. Their voices stir in surrounding air. The warmth of their hands assures us, and the gladness of our spoken names. This is the reason of cities, of homes, of assemblies, in houses of worship. It is good to be with one another." Our opening hymn today is number 6 in the gray hymnal, "As Long as I Have Breath," which I believe is going to be our hymn of the month. Michael, would you like to lead us?
before we have joys and sorrows this morning, Reverend Johnstone has an announcement to make.
So as we approached our theme of intention this month, the Sunday Services Committee returned to a discussion that's been alive for a while, how best to hear and receive joys and concerns that we share each week. And while we value the opportunity to connect with parts of each other's lives, we also recognize that people differ in their willingness to speak up before a gathered congregation, and that the mix of feelings and experiences can at times be disorienting, that joys and concerns are sometimes misused for announcements, and that not everyone is always as succinct as we might hope. So in this month of intention, we're experimenting with the way we do joys and concerns, beginning next week. So we will have cards in the narthex where you can write your joys and concerns, place them in the offering plate, and they will be read in the service. And you can identify yourself or not as you choose. So the Sunday Services Committee is receptive to your feedback. Please raise your hand if you're a member of that committee so that people will know who to complain to. Oh, I mean, Dick's barely raising his hand. Okay. You can speak to any of us about your experience with that or with any other aspect of our worship services. And thanks for your flexibility in adapting to different ways of being together in community.
As a community that cares for one another, we want to know about the significant events of one another's lives. We want to share so that we are known and supported. Together, our joys multiply and our sorrows diminish. At this time in our service, we join with many other Unitarian Universalist congregations in sharing what is in our hearts and in our minds. If there is an event in your life which moves you this morning to joy or sorrow, to hope or gratitude, that you want to share with the community, please raise your hand and a microphone will be brought to you. Please state your name and please hold the microphone directly in front of you as you speak. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Emily, and I wanted to express the joy that I'm actually back here today. I'm adjusting to grad school, and that kind of led to me dropping everything else in life. But I have actually a sorrow that I would like to share, and that is that my mother has been diagnosed with congestive heart failure, and they're still kind of working out what that means in terms of her having to adjust her expectations for what she can reasonably do in a day in her life.
My name's Rob DeLong. I just wanted to say that as cold as it's been, we served maybe 28 folks at the Happy Kitchen on Friday morning. And, yeah, just a concern that that's an ongoing thing.
J.C. Hamm, after a month of traveling with family, we are glad to be back. But most of all, Laura and I got engaged in December, so that is a huge joy for us.
Hi, I just want to add one more bit of information about the rally at the Topeka Capitol that's mentioned in the brochure, People's State of the State, 2018. There will be a bus. We've chartered a bus. The Manhattan Alliance for Peace and Justice has chartered a bus that will be leaving from the Texas Roadhouse, JCPenney area of the Town Center parking lot. We'll leave at 10, and we'll be talking to all our three representatives in the state capitol. We have appointments set up, and then we will be returning at around 2:15, getting back in Manhattan around 3:15. So hope you can join us on the bus. If there's not room, then be prepared to drive from the same location. Thank you.
There are seats on the front row.
My name is Jake, and on December 28th, I turned 10.
For these and all joys and sorrows held in our heart, we are grateful and contemplate their meaning in our lives. Now it's time for the children of all ages to come forward for our story, Musa and Najib. Good morning. Have you guys ever argued with any of your friends? Have you ever slapped any of your friends? No. It's good we don't resort to violence necessarily. Today's story, though, is going to talk about what happens when friends have disagreements, because one of the things about being in a community, large as we are, is that sometimes we don't always agree on things. And so this is an interesting story. It was written by a man who uses the pen name Malib Taham, but his real name is Julio Cesare de Melo de Souza, and he is from Brazil. And he was a mathematician, not necessarily a writer of children's stories. But he wrote The Man Who Counted, and it was first published in 1949, and this is one of the stories from that collection. Once, two friends named Musa and Najib made a journey through the mountains of Persia on a camelback. They came, after a time, to a place where a stream flowed by a sandy bank and trees gave shade. And if you've ever been to Persia, you know it's pretty hot in the summer, so that's a nice thing to have, shade. There, they had a discussion, which turned into an argument. Najib grew very angry, and for the first time ever, he slapped Musa across the face. Musa was stunned. He felt angry. He wanted to slap Najib back, but he thought, I cannot be too bad at my friend because I could have done the same thing. We are alike, and I care about him, and I don't want to fight with him anymore. So he walked over to the trees instead and picked up a stick. With the stick, he wrote in the sand, "Today, my best friend slapped me." Then he and his friends stood in silence and watched as the desert wind blew the words in the sand away. By the time the writing had disappeared, Najib had said that he was sorry. The friends got back on their camels and rode to their destination in a distant city. On their trip back, though, through the mountain pass, they once again stopped at the same river. This time, the two friends decided to take a swim. Since their first visit, the rains had made the current stronger, and the river was much deeper than it had been. Musa, the friend who had been slapped, stepped into the water first, and right away he slipped on a rock and was dragged under by the current and began to drown. Najib jumped in without a second thought and pulled his friend to safety. The two friends again sat in silence for some time until Musa had regained his breath. Then he rose and went to the saddlebags where he found a carving knife. This time he went to a rock near the river. Into the rock he carved these words, "Today, my best friend saved me." Again, the two friends sat in silence. Finally, Najib spoke. "My friend, after I hurt you, you wrote the words in the sand. Now, after I saved you, I wrote the words in stone. Why?" Musa replied, "When someone hurts us, we should write it down in sand, where the winds of forgiveness can erase it away. This way our hearts are free from bitterness and we can renew our friendships. But when someone does something kind to us, We must engrave it in stone and in our hearts so that we will never forget. Thank you, my friend, said Najib. I am very grateful for your friendship, and I don't ever want to hurt you again. The two friends embraced, got back on their camels, and continued their journey home. The end.
Go with love, our hearts go with you. Go in joy, our hopes go too. Learn in love and grow in wisdom. Shine your light in all you do.
In love, our hearts go with you. Go in joy, our hopes go too. Learn in love and grow in wisdom. Shine your light in all you do.
Our words for the offertory this morning come from Brandon Lovely. Let here be an offering to sustain and strengthen this place, which is sacred to many of us, a community of memory and hope, for we are now the keepers of the dream. We'll now have three testimonies as to why people are UUs in this congregation, and we'll start with Sandy Nelson, who is one of the rare ones here in that she is a lifelong UU.
Born and bred. My parents found Unitarianism at that time while they were in college in Boston. So they did the legwork, and I get to be lazy because that's what I am. And I'm told that the first service I ever attended as a swaddled infant was in California, and the special guests were Pete Seeger and Malvina Reynolds. Yeah, that's cool. So born and bred, that's why I'm a UU, and now I could leave the stage. But why am I a member of this fellowship? Well, I graduated from high school in Livermore, California, and some 40-odd years ago, and I left home and went to travel across the U.S. and Canada all by myself and settled into a job in Yosemite National Park and then decided to come here to go to school. And I thought myself rather worldly, and all my friends and family thought, K-State, California, Yosemite, K-State. So it was a little bit of a surprise, but here I was. And as an incoming freshman, I was required to live in the dorms. And that particular year, in that particular dorm, on that particular floor, in that particular wing of the co-ed dorm, there were 29 other freshman women who were 18 and straight out of high school from Kansas, and me, who was 21 and feeling worldly and full of myself. And it took me all of 10 days to just say, that's it, I'm done. But I remembered there was a sign on Bluemont Avenue, and where was a Unitarian church there? And so that next Sunday, I was there. I was welcomed with open arms. Ann Cowan still has fond memories of me showing up as a young, bright-eyed college student. So I've been here ever since. Bottom line, born and bred, moved away, sought out UUs, knowing they would be instant community. And instant community they have been. Got married, had kids, brought kids to UU, except for our oldest, Allison, who was really heavy into soccer when she was young, and soccer was always on Sundays for some reason, so David got to be soccer dad and I got to be church mom. So she was raised in a UU household, but not so much the UU community. And then she went to college, KU, and traveled a bit and moved away from home to Washington, D.C. And wouldn't you know, the first thing she did when she landed in a strange place was seek out a Unitarian Universalist church. Because she knew, she had learned, she had been ingrained, that she knew there would be folks there that were her folks, and she would get an instant community. So now, Allison is pregnant, and with any luck, come April, she will take her swaddled infant daughter to a UU church in Arlington somewhere, and that child will have its first attendance story to tell. And that's why I'm a UU.
Our next testimony will come from J.C. Hamm, a relative new member. J.C. is the assistant principal at the school I teach at over in Junction City.
Thank you, Chris. All right, Laura always jokes that I'm someone who thinks and writes in bullet points. I often thought of proposing to her in that way, but I opted to do otherwise. So here is why I'm a UU in bullet points. Number one, I believe everyone deserves to be loved. My experience with UU has been one of openness and non-judgmental love. Thank you for loving us. Number two, I believe it takes a village to raise a village. Thank you for contributing to the betterment of our community. Number three, I believe in the unique spiritual journey for every individual. Thank you for providing a non-shame-based, guilt-driven, or condemned path for my continued journey. Number four, I believe Earth is our home and we must take care of it. Thank you for the continued focus on nature and its protection. Number five, I believe that everyone has and deserves a voice, and I'm beginning to find mine here. Thank you for allowing me to reflect without judgment. Number six, I believe we all have an obligation to grow each other. Thank you for being a part of my growth. And number seven, I believe God represents to many people in many different ways. across all aspects of life. Thank you for allowing all of us to find our God, our energy, our love, or our purpose on our own time and in our own way. I could write on and on of all the reasons I'm a Unitarian Universalist. I want to contribute to the good in this world, and being a part of this fellowship helps me achieve that ambition. This place is one I never knew existed, growing up in very Catholic Northeast Iowa, but I always knew I needed. I am grateful for this fellowship, the space to learn and grow, but most of all for the friendships I have made. Thank you.
I, like several of you here, was raised in a Roman Catholic family. I survived Catholic schools and Catholic colleges. And I began my professional life as being a youth minister in the Diocese of Tulsa, Oklahoma. My first exposure to Unitarian Universalism was when I met people from All Souls Unitarian Church in Tulsa, Oklahoma. It was shortly after Ronald Reagan had become president, and he announced his intentions to reinstate registration for the draft. At the time, being a teacher and a youth minister, I felt it was important to let young Roman Catholics know the canonical laws concerning conscientious objection. So, in a newsletter that I published for the diocese, I included the canonical laws about conscientious objection. What followed basically was a right-wing lynching mob that wanted me immediately removed from my position. They wanted me to retract what I had said, and being a theology major, I knew that I was right and they were wrong, and so I wasn't going to retract anything and force the priest and the bishop to stand by me in that decision. I knew my contract would not be renewed, but what was interesting in all of that was that members of All Souls reached out to me because they had heard about the lynch mob that showed up at the Board of Education meeting, and they wanted me to know that there were people who thought like me. That's where I was introduced to the seven principles of Unitarian Universalism. Shortly after that, I left the U.S. I couldn't be here with Ronald Reagan. I'm contemplating doing the same thing now. But I returned in 1998 to take care of my father after my mother had died of cancer, and I felt in order to integrate into a community I'd long been not part of, I had left Kansas in 1976, I quickly realized that K-State was not going to offer me the liberal community I'd been used to at the University of Naples, where communists outnumbered non-communists almost 3-1. I was going to have to become part of some community. And here in Kansas, we base our connections primarily through family and faith communities. By this time in my life, I really didn't believe in God. And so I remembered the good people from All Souls in Tulsa, and I went to the UUA website and found that there was a little church called the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan, Kansas. So 19 years ago this month, I came through the door, sat down, and listened to the first lay-led service of a Unitarian, and I quickly realized that the people shared very similar interests, views, and life goals as what I did. So why do I remain a Unitarian Universalist? Some years ago, we had a young man who was here, and I can't remember his name right now, but he was in the U.S. military. And when he was stationed in Iraq, fighting in the Iraq War, he had taken an online test to determine his religious ideology, and he discovered that he, too, was a Unitarian Universalist. So I went to the website, I took the test, I came out 97% liberal Quaker and only 78% Unitarian Universalist. In my reading about Unitarian Universalism since I joined the fellowship, one book in particular has really made an impression on my life, and that is Being Liberal in an Illiberal Age by Jack Mendelsohn. He speaks most clearly, I think, and I'd like to quote him here. He, in defining exactly what is liberalism, he states, Liberalism means celebrating and practicing the importance of persons, their interests, their inherent freedom to think, speak, associate, hear, read, see, and learn. To perfect freedom, but not perfect freedom, but responsible freedom, become manifest in particulars of our lives. It means warmly embracing political democracy and constitutional, compassionate government. Among its meanings are social justice, popular education, equal opportunity and access, peaceful resolution of conflict, broad tolerance of diversity, the scientific spirit of inquiry, a rational outlook, a relativistic philosophy, and an ethno-social religion, end quote. What Mendelssohn defines is pretty much the antithesis of a lot of what surrounds us today in contemporary U.S. society. Today, I really don't believe there is a God. Thus, I don't come here for what would be defined as traditional spiritual nourishment. I come here to be nourished by new ideas and to keep alive those values of liberalism I hold dear. I am a UU today because I feel connected with something much larger than myself. I belong to a community of like-minded people, which is a richly woven tapestry of experiences, abilities, and talents that never cease to amaze me. I would not find this tapestry if I was not here in this congregation. I am proud of the contributions UUs have made historically to our nation and its history on the issues of slavery, suffrage, civil rights, and LGBT equality. Those contributions encourage and inspire me to keep fighting even when the future appears to be quite bleak. They also challenge me to look for the positive, which is really difficult some days, and to speak out when it's rather uncomfortable to do so. Finally, being a UU allows me the freedom to feel comfortable with uncertainty. Much of religion is organized around rote memorization of rules and regulations. But if there is anything Unitarians or Universalists can agree on, it is that the only thing that any of us can be certain about is that we can be certain of nothing. We will now sing One More Step, hymn number 168.
Don't take anything symbolic or theological or anything from the fact that I am sitting today. I fell. I hurt my leg. I do not want to stand behind a pulpit for 20 minutes because it will hurt too much. So, here I am. I appreciate the stories that Christopher and JC and Sandy shared. Varied stories, various lengths of time of being UU, varied interpretations. Unitarian Universalism lives in the voices of people who have made the commitment to live as UU. We heard about spiritual development, we heard about community, we heard about political action. All of these are part of who we are. I've been a UU for over 35 years. And during that time, my theology has shifted and changed according to my understandings of the moment. And that is something incomprehensible to many people who believe that ultimate truth is both knowable and unchangeable. They think that a particular book or set of doctrines defines eternal truth. Well, UUs deny that approach to reality. So much of knowledge is culturally dependent, so differs in different times and places and contexts, even from person to person, based on individual experience and temperament. And I think we heard a little bit of that in our stories. Different life experiences bring us to different places. Yet we still have to operate in the world as if something were true and right, dependable, even if we cannot be scientifically certain of it. Otherwise, how do I know that acting authentically is better than acting with deceit? Now, that depends on my goals and values, not on anything that can be proven. Why pursue beauty, justice, or compassion? We have no evidence that these lead to the best way to live. We simply trust that it is so. And as I said, what I feel compelled to trust in, to believe by my conscience, reason, and intuition has not remained the same through the 35 plus years that I've been UU. As I've learned more about myself, about other people, and about the world, now I don't say that as a UU I can believe anything I want to, but I do say that I am trusted to believe as my conscience and process dictates. And as my beliefs and values evolve, I can stay in the same religious tradition. That is a gift. More than once I've said that Unitarian Universalism is not an easy religion. We don't supply answers. We don't even dictate a particular process to get to the answers. I don't expect you to believe anything based on my authority or on the authority of any particular book. I'll borrow from my colleague Mark Christian and say that my reflections are not meant to tell you how you must live your life. I am holding up my lens to life and telling you what I see. And you aren't expected to see the same things or even apply the same lens. Perhaps, though, you can learn something about your own lens and about how one applies a particular lens. Maybe you'll have insights from my insights. And as a UU, you have to work out for yourself what you think about human nature, about God, about where we come from and where we're going. Or not. You actually don't have to work it out. One of the blessings of Unitarian Universalism when I first found it was that I didn't have to know what I thought about God. I didn't have to know whether or not God was real. I could bask in uncertainty. And I did for a number of years. After a while, though, many of us are dissatisfied with uncertainty and want to seek out answers for ourselves, if only to know how to prioritize what we do in the world. And this is where UUism gets hard. It's not tough to bask in the uncertainty, but it may be unsatisfying. And I think that may be where we lose some people who are here for a few years and drift away. Others I know actually find a different course, a particular way of thinking and believing and living. I was deeply touched when a member of a former congregation came to me and shared her story of how UUism had helped her find Buddhism. And she had joined a sangha that helped her live her best life. She felt fondness still for Unitarian Universalism, but was ready to say goodbye to the congregation. So when a member leaves to join a Buddhist Sangha or to return to their Episcopal roots, I feel we've done our job. I'm more disappointed if someone leaves to go nowhere in particular and has not discovered more about themselves and their path by being part of this congregation. And what I really want to address today is how to prevent that drifting away. How do we move from being casually UU, being here because our friends are here, because it feels good, because we're comfortable, and taking it deeper, becoming intentionally UU. Today is a particularly good day to do that because we have the traveling chalice with us. It's a symbol that sits on the stage at the General Assembly during all the meetings where decisions are made and reports are given and delegates argue and press their case. The symbol reminds us as we gather to govern ourselves as an association of our shared values and principles. It invites us to be intentional about how we act with one another, how we decide our priorities, and how we handle our decision-making process. Here today, the chalice reminds us, as Christopher said, of our connections with all the other UU congregations we are associated with. We're only a small group here, less than 100 people. But today, thousands of UUs gather in their congregations, most of them with a chalice in a place of honor before them, reminding them too of their connections with Unitarian Universalist values and principles and with us. And the second reason that this is a good day to have this GA chalice is that following the service, members will be gathered as a congregation to make decisions about the future. And as at GA, the chalice invites everyone to be intentional about how they act with one another, how they decide priorities, and how they handle the decision-making process. Appropriate practices for a congregational meeting. So, what do I mean by being intentionally UU? Let's look first at intention. According to an order of service from the First Universalist Church of Minneapolis, intention literally means a stretching out of mind, of heart, of body, of spirit. Less poetically, intention means a focus of attention, bending the mind and spirit in a particular direction. In other words, it's making conscious choices all the time. Too often as human beings, we find ourselves acting without consciousness, either being stuck in habit or reacting to others as if by reflex, either against what is coming at us or joining in with the crowd. The poet E.E. Cummings once noted that the world is doing its best night and day to make you everybody else. We are easily swayed as human beings, easily distracted from our intention. And this is not our fault. We are, after all, human. But in order to be fully ourselves, we have to engage with others without reactivity, neither joining the crowd from peer pressure nor responding to adrenaline with fight or flight as we feel challenged. Instead, we need to strive, as transcendentalist writer Henry David Thoreau said, to live deliberately. Thoreau famously retreated to the woods of Walden Pond for 2 years to live deliberately. He was an interesting character. He grew up as a Unitarian, but didn't hold on to that commitment, drifting or maybe deliberately moving away from the church. He formally withdrew his membership when asked to contribute to the church when there was a minister there he didn't like. I'm not sure how that fits into being intentionally Unitarian, though I do know he was not the last Unitarian to express his opinion that way. And maybe that was reactive rather than acting with intention. Hard to say so many years in retrospect. Thoreau named his religion as nature. nature. We see it here all the time. But on his friend Emerson's insistence, he was buried at the Unitarian Church. So Thoreau was born and died Unitarian, and I'd say lived under the influence of it. But despite his rejection of the church, he demonstrated something of what it means to live intentionally Unitarian, to make choices even when it's not clear there is a choice, resisting both habit and pressure toward conformity. Besides living in the woods, and to be honest, he could easily walk into town, and often did, so he was not as isolated as one might guess. But he resisted the Mexican War by refusing to pay taxes and defended John Brown's violent efforts to overthrow slavery. Now, I don't know if in his time and place I would have made the same choices he did. Clearly, though, he was intentional, striving to act in accord with his values. As you use, we embrace choice and freedom. Sometimes we don't recognize how hard it is, though, to make choices, to make free choices. We have to try to be conscious even in what we pay attention to. Mostly, though, we apply intent to growing into the person we want to become. Or as Gandhi, who did study Thoreau, said, be the change you want to see in the world. As you use, we draw from various sources informing and pursuing our intentions. Philip Moffat offers this guidance from the Buddhist tradition. Setting intention is different from goal making. It is not oriented toward a future outcome. Instead, it is a path or practice that is focused on how you are being in the present moment. Your attention is on the ever-present now in the constantly changing flow of life. You set your intentions based on understanding what matters most to you and make a commitment to align your worldly actions with your inner values. UU Minister Jen Crow calls it strategic intention rather than strategic planning, stressing that our values inform everything. Now, some people would even describe acting with this sort of intention as connecting with what is sacred. Clearly, such careful living and self-examination is not exclusively UU. However, William Ellery Channing, the first Unitarian minister on this continent to openly embrace the label, preached one of his most famous sermons on what he called self-culture, a rigorous approach to life that combined intellectual rigor, self-examination, and moral action. Back in 1838, when he preached that sermon, worship services generally lasted a couple of hours, and most of it was taken up by preaching. And I know that everyone here, including me, is glad that is no longer the case. So I'll give you only a few of Channing's best tidbits. Self-culture, he says, does not demand sacrifice of individuality. It does not regularly apply and establish machinery for the sake of torturing everyone into one rigid shape called perfection. As the human countenance, with the same features in us all, is diversified without end in the race and is never the same in any two individuals, so the human soul, with the same grand powers and laws, expands into an infinite variety of forms and would be woefully stinted by modes of culture requiring all to learn the same lesson or bend to the same rules. Here, Channing reminds us of the importance of individuality, which I find is a strong instinct among UUs. We're not looking to attain, as he says, a particular form of perfection, rather pursuing the best person each individual can be, drawing on their own unique strengths and recognizing that that will create a rich diversity in community. Channing speaks of the importance of books, of the need to expose ourselves to the thoughts of wise thinkers, and of how to discern wisdom from intuitive flashes of revelation. And he writes, be true to your own highest convictions. This is a reminder that this is not only a process of self-examination, but requires a commitment to living out the values that we determine we have. This is another way that UUism is hard. First, we have to determine our own values and beliefs, and then we have to live them. And as we live out those values, we discover and learn more about ourselves and our world, which contributes to our continued improvement. It's what would be called today an action-reflection model. We act in the world in accord with our values and then come back and reflect on how that has played out. And our action informs our reflection, and our reflection informs our action. Or as Channing says, all parts of our condition may be pressed into the service of self-improvement. So, action is required. Never, though, in isolation from reflection on our role and how we play it out. I'll turn for a moment to someone from the Catholic tradition whom I deeply respect, Richard Rohr, who's the founder of the Center for Action and Contemplation, and who does so well in linking these two aspects, action and contemplation. He writes, over the years, I've met many social activists who were doing excellent social analysis and advocating for crucial justice issues, but they were not working from an energy of love, except in their own minds. They were still living out of their false self with the need to win, the need to look good, the attachment to a superior, politically correct self-image. They might have the answer, but they are not themselves the answer. In fact, they're often part of the problem. That's one reason that most revolutions fail, he says. Too many reformers self-destruct from within. For that very reason, he writes, Jesus and great spiritual teachers first emphasized transformation of the consciousness and soul. Unless that happens, there's no lasting or grounded reform or revolution. When a subjugated people rise to power, they often become as controlling and dominating as their oppressors because the same demon of power has never been exorcised from them. We need less reformation and more transformation. Or as he paraphrases Albert Einstein, no problem can be solved by the same consciousness that created it. So action and reflection cannot be in isolation from one another. They work hand in hand, each influencing the other. And I'd be remiss if I neglected, as we talk about one of the most important source documents that addresses our values. And those values are articulated in our principles. And if you haven't memorized them, no one has memorized them. Look at in the gray hymnal, in front of the first hymn, the last page in front of the first hymn, and there are our principles. This is not a set of ideals that we accept carelessly. I'll invite you just to read them with me. Okay? We, the member congregations of the Unitarian Universalist Association, covenant to affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person, justice, equity, and compassion in human relations, acceptance of one another, and encouragement to spiritual growth in our congregations, a free and responsible search for truth and meaning, the right of conscience, and the use of the democratic process within our congregations and in society at large, the goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all, respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. And so these are our principles. And I've heard people say, well, of course, any reasonable person would accept these. Not so fast. To be intentionally UU, rather than casually so, We apply our reason and experience and bring questions even to these. Some of the best conversations I've had have been around the struggles you use have with these principles. Take the first one, respect for the inherent worth and dignity of every person. The challenges come when we wonder, does every person really have inherent worth and dignity? Can certain actions by people negate their worth and dignity? Is worth and dignity really inherent? That is it inborn? Or maybe it's given, bequeathed, rather than inborn. Maybe it's not only human beings that have inherent worth and dignity. Maybe other living beings have that same quality. See how many questions can arise? I knew a former Quaker who became UU and, as a proponent of consensus, questioned the use of and the commitment to democracy, the fifth principle. I've had people wonder about the goal of world community. How does that fit into being a citizen of a nation? Does it bring patriotism into a question? And now there's a move to add an eighth principle and to revise the wording of the first. And as a movement, we believe in moving, not standing still. Ever learning, ever adapting. These aren't things set in stone, given from some power outside ourselves. These are principles that we have determined and voted on and discussed because they're the best that we can discern. That doesn't mean they're eternal truth. So, the principles can provide some grounding for our reflection, but determining our values by looking to UU principles and to whatever other sources inspire and have a hold on us is just the first step, as I said. Striving to live by those values is the other part that makes UUism a difficult religion. I mentioned in my newsletter column this month how pleased I am that of those who responded to the recent survey of members, that 61% had attended local rallies for social causes, that 30% had attended city commission member meetings, and that 27% had attended statewide rallies. There are, of course, many ways to live out our values, by how we interact with our families, friends, and coworkers, by the livelihood we pursue, by giving of ourselves through volunteering for others. An important way to live our values, particularly in these times, though, is to advocate for our government to align with the values we endorse. And that's, you know, looking at the Kansas People's Agenda meeting coming up Wednesday. You know, Christopher, John, or I can all tell you more about it. But that's one of those ways we play out and live out our values. So finally, to be intentionally UU means to discover and live your value in covenant with other Unitarian Universalists. The truth is, we can't call Thoreau a Unitarian because he did choose to live outside rather than within that covenant. Unitarian Universalism is relational. We call one another to their best selves as well as striving for that goal ourselves. Perhaps no one has described it better than A. Powell Davies did. He was mid-20th century Unitarian minister who served the All Souls Church in Washington, D.C., and helped build a network of congregations through the D.C. suburbs that survive and thrive today. That was one of those congregations was the one that Sandy was talking about her daughter attending. He wrote, "Let me tell you why I come to church. I come to church and would, whether I was a preacher or not, because I fall below my own standards and need to be constantly brought back to them. I am afraid of becoming selfish and indulgent. And my church of the free spirit, brings me back to what I want to be. I could easily despair. Doubt and dismay could overwhelm me. My church renews my courage and my hope. It's not enough that I should think about the world and its problems at the level of a newspaper report or magazine discussion. it could too soon become too low a level. I must have my conscience sharpened until it goads me to the most thorough and responsible thinking of which I'm capable. I must feel again the love I owe to others. I must not only hear about it, but feel it. In church, I do. I'm brought toward my best, in every way toward my best. I hope you feel somewhat the same way about coming to church and recognizing that perfection is never attained. I fear this reflection today may be too grounded in the past and in voices of white men, and forgive me this. It may not speak strongly enough of our future orientation, of our commitment to feminist principles, of our grassroots orientation, and of our growing recognition of the limitations of privileging the white narrative. In coming weeks this month, there will be more conscious, intentional attention to other points of view. And in the meantime, let me close this reflection with words from one of our foremost theologians, the African-American woman Tandeka, who wrote of Channing and another 19th century minister, Hosea Ballou, making a point that applies much more widely to all of us. We look to their lives rather than to their ideas to resolve the conflict between them. We discover ways in which their own lives might have shaped their distinct doctrines of human nature. Their doctrines are not in conflict. Their life experiences differed. Their lives illuminate their doctrine. Thus, the legacy they bequeath to us is not theologically conflicted, but experientially descriptive of different states of human experience. All of our theologies describe the diversity of our life experiences. Remember this diversity. Pay attention to the social contexts. Keep eyes focused on the people. Speak with compassionate understanding, and our new words for life will include us all ever anew. So may it be. Our closing hymn is 1017. 1017 in the turquoise, in the whatever color that is, the bluish book.
Thank you.
with the words of Eric Wickstrom. If you are who you were, and if the person next to you is who he or she was, if none of us has changed since the day we came in here, we have failed. The purpose of this community is to help its people grow. We do this through encounters with the unknown in ourselves, in one another, in the other, whoever that might be for us, however hard that might be, because these encounters have many gifts to offer. So may you go forth from here this morning, not who you were, but who you could be. So may we all. Amen.